Welcome to Screen Talk, New Wire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. We have a lot to talk about this weekend, from the disastrous fall season as it pertains to the big blockbusters, closing of movie theaters, all kinds of award season updates. But first, let's get the important stuff out of the way, our Zoom backgrounds. So I'm here with Dick Johnson. Dick Johnson is Dead, a movie we've talked about before, out on Netflix now. People should totally watch it. It's an amazing, powerful, poignant, and funny, strange movie from Kristen Johnson, which I know you're a fan of, too. And you're hanging out with Mads Mikkelsen drinking a beer from Another Round. How's that going?
I love this movie. I saw it at TIFF, and it's one of the movies that has been picked up, actually, by Goldman. And I was a little bit surprised, actually, that it wasn't Magnolia or one of the usual Scandinavian suspects. But Goldman's going to give it a big push for Best International Film. Denmark hasn't announced yet, but that's the film that is likely to go in. And Mads Mikkelsen at his absolute best. It's about a bunch of teachers who are having a midlife crisis, let's say, and these guys all decide that the secret sauce for success is getting drunk every day. And I have to tell you that there's a great deal of ebullient fun to be had, but there's a dark side to drinking every day.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching that. I mean, both of these movies, Dick Johnson is Dead, you know, Kristen Johnson's very personal movie about sort of the dread and anticipation of her father's death and how she imagines it with him. They're both kind of these serial comic studies of people dealing with a certain kind of stage of life. And what I enjoyed about Another Round, I'm sure Goldwyn's not going to love you saying that you thought it was going to go to somebody else. But, you know, that what's interesting about this movie is that it does seem on the surface like a tough sell. I mean, go watch a bunch of depressed guys go through a midlife crisis by drinking a bunch. But it's actually really entertaining.
It's about a lot of other things. It's very entertaining, and it's a great way to get into the subject of depression and distancing in marriages and, you know, all sorts of other things, and how to rediscover the joy in your life when it's gone. As far as, you know, Goldman landed the movie, the question is why they landed it. And that has a lot to do with the current climate in distribution right now, which is troubled. And it has everything to do with the world we're living in, the pandemic, the fear of the marketplace not coming back anytime soon, fear of going into theaters, not knowing exactly when New York and L.A. are going to come back. Obviously, we've seen Regal announce that they're going to close hundreds of theaters in the United States over the next few months. You know, they're not going to be open. Others say they're going to stay open, but we don't know how AMC is going to do with its financial problems. All of these things. The theaters are mainly because of the big movies pulling out, the theaters are in great disarray.
Yeah.
But before we get into all of that, I want to say that Dick Johnson is Dead. I watched this great Q&A that Mike Mills, the filmmaker who did Beginnings and who knows a lot about elderly parents on their way out the door. He did a great Q&A with Kristen Johnson, and I got to cover that and write it up, and it is entertaining to read about that, I think.
Yeah, it's a fun movie to talk about, too, because it's such a unique project wedded to her personality. And if there was ever a time where I would love to see Netflix data, it would be right now. I mean,
I have no idea. Yeah. It's a top front runner in the Oscar documentary race. That's one thing I can claim. And we're all in the, you know, part of what's going on right now is that we're watching a lot of these documentaries as they come down the pike. There's so many good ones this year, and we're also catching up on all the foreign films. So I did put a story up about the Best International Feature Film race, which is fascinating this year because everybody's going to be able to watch it online.
Which, of course, they should have been doing for a long period of time. So it's almost like the upside in the weirdness of 2020 is that, you know, for people who just pay attention to the kind of big, splashy narratives of Oscar season, here's an opportunity to actually dig deeper and pay attention to the stuff that could actually benefit from that boost in a totally different kind of way. Docs, foreign language films, all that stuff.
Well, what I figured out is that even though we missed some of the big festivals happening in real life, including Telluride and Cannes, a lot of these, the selection, the Cannes selection moved its way through all these other festivals that did take place. And even if they took place in this sort of half local, half virtual universe, they had an impact. And there's some European festivals that are still going on. And what I realize is that the European festivals have had a huge impact. Especially on this particular terrain, the international.
Well, they really happened. Market. I mean, there is still value in a physical event if you can have it. Apparently, the Venice Film Festival, the bump that Nomadland got from winning the top prize there, and now the London Film Festival is about to happen. So it's fascinating to see the contrast between where they're at over there and what we're kind of having to deal with over here, the fragmentation of all that. Although I have to say, I've enjoyed going to the drive-in for New York Film Festival. I saw American Utopia for the second time as a big screen experience with everyone honking their horns after every musical number.
I wish I could have been there.
It was really fun. And the other thing that I thought about after that was that, you know, the Academy has announced that drive-in screenings count for Oscar qualification. So it made me wonder just how much could that have an impact. I mean, something like American Utopia, an HBO documentary, wasn't even necessarily going for a theatrical life. But I guess by these rules now, you could say it qualifies.
All right. So what is that going to do? Six cities, including LA, which always was the qualifying city for the Academy. And so there are theaters in some theaters open in California, including drive-in. So this gives people the option of going to see something at a drive-in. I would say Nomadland was the best drive-in experience I've had, the one at the Rose Bowl that was put on by Telluride and Searchlight, and they did it in such a good, high-quality way that it was a wonderful experience. But I have to say, and you probably had good experiences under the New York Film Festival auspices in New York, but the everyday drive-in experience is not a good one. Let's just be clear. I don't think
that the traditional theatrical experience is still the ideal way to experience most of these movies, bottom line. And it's not seeing them at drive-ins, and it's not watching them in virtual platforms but everybody's had to, you know, sort of adapt.
So what it really means is that you can qualify something. And so that takes care of that. I think for the people who are the Academy watchers who are missing terribly the experience you're describing, and are used to going to the best theater in LA, the Academy, you know, theater, the Goldwyn, they're miserable about having to see things this way. And I don't think the drive-ins are going to be the ideal for them.
No, it's not going to help, but it does make me wonder what kind of loopholes will come up. I mean, hey, you can now stop arguing about whether or not Lover's Rock qualifies, because if they wanted to qualify it, it has, right? Because it was the opening night of this festival as a drive-in.
I wouldn't put anything past Netflix, you know? I mean, honestly, Lover's Rock and the other two films in the Small Axe trilogy have gotten their most extraordinary reviews of any three films I can think of. I mean, they're just
amazing.
And that's
Amazon. But Amazon wants to put it up as a miniseries for an Emmys play.
I know.
And Steve McQueen is talking about them as films. So, you know, who has the upper hand there?
Did I say Netflix? Netflix is like a default at this point because of their extraordinary lineup that's unfolding. So we've seen some trailers, and you and I both thought that the News of the World trailer looked pretty damn good, the Paul Greengrass with Tom Hanks. And now
one
the
always
Mank
hopes
trailer broke. And that looks, I'm fascinated by that, because you can have this black and white evocation of the world of Citizen Kane, which is probably one of the best known movies that has ever been made, you know, along with Casablanca or something, or Gone with the Wind. You know, everybody has seen Citizen Kane at this point, and you can see all the references and the style, and you can see David Fincher going wild with it. You can't imagine, though, that they would have gotten away with taking that movie and putting it in theaters and getting, and really having a successful movie. Because, and what's great about Netflix is that Fincher could indulge his cinephile style fantasies on this. And you can also see that it's the kind of movie the Academy could really respond to, because it's about an artist, a struggling artist in Hollywood who isn't, you know, it isn't easy to be a creative artist in Hollywood. It never has been. So,
and that's a standard kind of slot where you have the movie that celebrates showbiz that resonates with the members of showbiz. It's the artist effect of sorts. And
looking at
this movie and what it's about, it's going to stir up conversation because, as you say, Citizen Kane is the proverbial best movie of all time, though I'd say Touch of Evil is slightly better, and F for Fake
you
is one
and I
of my
both love Touch of Evil
time.
But Citizen Kane deserves its place. It does. It holds up.
But you know, the thing about this movie obviously is that it's about the screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz and how he sort of originated that storyline. And the, you know, I think Pauline Kael essay Raising Kane that took the sort of authorship of Citizen Kane into question is something worth taking a look at to prepare for this movie, because one of the things that I think is going to be fascinating to talk about is if it is the so-called greatest movie of all time, is this movie the ultimate behind-the-scenes story, or are some Hollywood insiders going to say it's sacrilege because it's, you know, changing the narrative around you know.
Well, there are a bunch of these things coming up. I mean, they're going to do Chinatown. It's a thing. They're going to do The Godfather. They've already Hollywood was a big hit on Netflix. I'm curious to see how far they go with this. So basically, Netflix has this extraordinary lineup, and we've already seen the Charlie Kaufman. I'm Thinking of Ending Things. We've gone through Chicago. Trial of the Chicago 7, which is going to be hitting Netflix on the 16th of October. And then, you know, it's in theaters now in some form or other. And they've got The Boys in the Band, you know, that got great reviews. They've got Over the Moon, this amazing animated film that's coming up. They've got Rebecca, the Hitchcock thing, which I'm curious to see. It looks terrible to me, but we'll see. You know,
Out. Did you see Boys in the Band? I thought what was notable about Boys in the Band is that it's a play, obviously, and the sort of the chief strength it has is that if you don't know this play, it's now kind of captured on Netflix with some very showy, mostly enjoyable performances, but I wouldn't call it some, you know, grand cinematic adaptation. It's not like the Friedkin film or something like that, you know, brought into the contemporary era. It's the play. So I think when we look at this huge slate, it's going to be fascinating each couple of weeks for us to reassess it and see, you know, which ones really stand up as the season goes on, because each of these films seems to have a very different kind of profile and it's going to hit in a different kind of way. So
they've got 40-year-old version, which was the Sundance
there's
film.
One.
They've got
I
the
saw
Sophia
that back
Lawrence
in Sundance. I haven't seen
back.
The new cut though. So
yeah, they re-edited that. They've got the sort of Holocaust Madame Rosa remake, if you like, from Sophia Loren. And then that may or may not be the Italian entry. And then they've got Hillbilly Elegy, the Ron Howard with Glenn Close and Amy Adams, and then you have Mank. We talked. This is the order that they're coming out in. So we're heading December now, and then we have Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which had a big story in the New York Times, which Chadwick Boseman, and you've got Chadwick Boseman going against Da 5 Bloods, the Spike Lee, which is a big contender already as well. And we'll see which categories they end up in. My guess, Chadwick Boseman, lead, Ma Rainey, supporting Da 5 Bloods.
So I think it's notable that, you know, you just outlined this very robust fall slate from Netflix.
And there's
which
three more
we,
after
we have
that.
An opportunity. Yeah, and we have an opportunity to look at that now in light of a very dramatic update to the fall season, not having a Bond film, not having Dune. There's not really any movies of, high profile, aside from maybe News of the World, that are coming to theaters before the end of the year. And a lot of theaters are going to be closed. So just circling back on that, I think that it's worth digging into this a little bit more, because it does raise some really significant questions about how any films are going to come back. I mean, even if, let's say, we have some kind of vaccine by the end of this year, if it happens, like Kamala Harris says, if the only person who says a vaccine is valid is Donald Trump, don't take it. But if the other scientists, the scientists say it's good, then we should take it. If that happens at the end of the year, it's not like, okay, now we can all go back to movie theaters again. You know, and the, all these movies are kind of floating in the ether. I mean, things being redated for October 2021 doesn't sound like a particularly reassuring kind of thing to just plant your flag on. So one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is what is the future of exhibition now from a business standpoint? Because if you have a big movie that you need to play on a ton of different screens to have any kind of impact, then you're kind of screwed for the foreseeable future. I mean, how are you processing this?
You are, until they bring back New York and LA. And until you have a big enough number of screens. But it isn't about that. The point, the reason, the real point, the real reason why it's not working, people are afraid to go. You can't make it happen unless people are ready to sit and see. I went to a screening. I actually went to one and I survived, I think. It was a week ago.
What did you see?
I can't say. Something I can't talk about, but it was fun. It was great to see it in a theater. It was a private screening room at a production company, and it was two people.
Oh, that doesn't count. You survived sitting in a room with two people. That's the thing. It's like I've been to a couple screenings here in New York with two.
I'm very conservative about this. I want to survive.
No, I'm not blaming you. I think you did the right. You're doing the right thing at 100%. But what I'm saying is, I've been to screening rooms in New York. It was certainly nice to sit down in a room with a bunch of chairs and vaguely be able to hear another person's reaction in the dark room at certain key moments, like aspects of the theatrical experience were there. But it's not getting in a room with a crowded group of people. And that seems to be, unless you want another version of the Rose Garden Massacre, the kind of thing that's just not tenable for a long period of time. It will come back in some capacity, but it is, look, it's just for these big movies. When?
I keep hearing these stories. There was another story on Twitter today of the wife of a major film critic who tested positive for COVID. And you know that these are people who are careful and do everything right, who don't take chances. You never know when you're going to get hit with something, and or when you're the one who's receptive to it. And luckily, in that case, the rest of the family was not. I'm speaking about something that we all are afraid of, and I should probably stick to movies.
Well, but it is relevant because the public safety issue has affected every level of society and the industry that we're in. And one of the things that I keep coming back to is the Academy made this dramatic decision, but an understandable one at the time, to move its show to later in the season, buying time for some movies that might launch at Sundance or another period of time. But it is a really interesting question now, not knowing when and how exhibition experiences are going to come back, whether or not that decision is really going to benefit any of the films that thought they could benefit from that extra time, the January through February extra time that they now have.
So we're getting a clearer picture of what some of the other movies are. There's also something called United States versus Billie Holiday that Paramount is going to put out in December, and Respect, which MGM is going to put out, and so there's some big star vehicles that are coming. If Searchlight chooses to wait on the Taika Waititi next goal wins, maybe A24 puts Come On into Sundance, the Mike Mills film. We'll see what ends up playing. There's a lot of conservatism, a lot of pulling back, but there's still a long list of movies that need the Oscars and are going to take advantage of what room there is left in December, January, February for some of this stuff to happen.
But in such a pliable year for qualifications, it almost seems like if you have, I don't totally understand the logic in waiting for, let's say, Sundance, unless you are the movie and you're super confident that this movie is going to really take off from having that platform at that particular point in time.
Sure, I think it's going to be a big platform. I think
but it's got to be strong enough to do that. Otherwise, sure. I would say just get it out there now and compete for, because it's not that much noise right now.
I think that the theatrical distributors are accustomed to being able to amass a certain kind of volume of noise at a festival, and they think they still need that, and they haven't gotten it really the way they like it. And Sundance is the first opportunity to do it. By the way, AFI's coming up next week, and we've got Julia Hart's I'm Not Your Woman coming up, and we've got the closing night, My Psychedelic Love Story from Errol Morris. So there's some new things coming at the AFI Fest as well in LA. That's our local festival.
Yeah.
Virtual, I mean,
I'm certainly looking forward to both of those movies. I think that the contrast is pretty severe when you think about what AFI has launched in recent years. Spielberg movies, Selma, I think, you know, Clint Eastwood's American Sniper. So it gives you a sense of just how much people are kind of holding back degree. And it's tricky. But then the Netflix films are not doing festivals, so they're picking their individual moments to go into all this. And I almost wonder if, you know, now that we've gotten through the first spate of fests, we've gotten through Venice and TIFF in New York, and got a Telluride lineup and stuff like that. It's like, I feel, I'm curious to see when we get more movies to kind of gnaw on, because
Netflix movie that I didn't mention is Midnight Sky, Clooney. That's the one that's coming later in December. George Clooney's
movie.
Yeah,
there's
one. He's doing a tribute at the London Film Festival. So that's sort of Netflix coming back into using a film festival to make some promotional noise. And I think we could see them continuing to do that going forward.
Sure. I mean, if they're willing to put some have some sort of presence at these events, then that's certainly worth something. And, you know, I think also it's notable that it's significant that the regional festivals are ongoing too, the ones that can play a role in buzz piggybacking off of the buzz from the bigger festivals. Like I know we've both been moderating some stuff for the Hamptons Film Festival.
Yeah.
I just moderated a conversation with Steven Yeun for Minari, which I saw back in Sundance. And of course he's amazing in that. We tried to make the supporting actor campaign for him on Burning Work and it didn't quite get there. But I think with something like Minari, which, you know, A24 is really going to push, that could really benefit in a weird year like this, because it's a smaller, quieter film, but it's a beloved actor, and it's a film that I think is small and resonant in a way that is hard to compete with the big, noisy, expensive stuff, but in a year that's so fragmented and unexpected could actually kind of be pushed up to some degree. So I'd love to see that continue to be part of the conversation too.
I think Minari is going to have a much bigger profile because of its slimmer year. And A24 certainly, and it's a good movie. It's a wonderful movie, I hope everybody watches it. It's a good one.
So before we wrap this week, we probably should talk a bit more about the most riveting 90-minute experience on a screen this week, which was the vice presidential debates. I know you're not particularly invested in any of that, but I have to tell you.
What do you mean I'm not invested in it?
You're not interested in talking about it in this context.
Kamala Harris totally rocked, and she handled herself really well, because when you're a woman, and you're in, as you know, from Hillary and what Hillary went through, or Elizabeth Warren, Kamala is the best I've seen yet in terms of experiencing mansplaining, holding her own, having this guy just talking over her, talking over the moderator. And she had to stay smiley and soft and strong and not too strident all at the same time, and still get her points across to the American people, the most repeated thing. But she did it.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of her. And, you know, you're going to talk about the distraction of the night.
The fly and the bloody eye. I mean, here's the thing. If you had a pitch meeting or a writing session on something like this, people would say it was so heavy-handed. I mean, it just felt like you can't make this stuff up. Watching something like this, it was so ludicrous. And yes, the visual contrast between her reactions and the way that she sort of navigated his lies was riveting, because there were so many moments where you realized that each second could make a difference in terms of the mood in the room and how it played. And 90 minutes is the exact right length for this kind of thing. All these people are saying it was like more civil relative to the previous debate. I just found it more watchable, period, because it felt like the ultimate window into a rational approach to running a country with the best interests of its citizens versus the nonsense we've been dealing with in the last 4 years. And by the way, I was thinking next time you interrupt me, I'm going to try that. Excuse me, I'm speaking, and then, you know, just see how it plays out. But I think the contrast might not work quite as well. What do you think?
You and I have been getting along. Let's just keep it that way.
Yeah, we don't debate in quite the same fervent way, but these next few weeks should be interesting. I mean, just today as we were recording, there was this whole thing where like the Commission for Presidential Debates wanted to go virtual, which, as you know, has its limitations, and Trump said he wouldn't do it. So this drama is going to keep playing out. I mean, obviously, bottom line, people need to vote, register to vote, tell your friends to vote, send postcards to vote, all that kind of stuff.
I got my ballot. I'm studying my propositions, and I'll get it out to the drop box in my neighborhood as soon as I can.
Good stuff. And then once you do all that, settle in and enjoy the show. I think it's okay to do that as long as we keep our eye on the ball, which is getting through November 3rd, and then we can go back to worrying about the stuff that we tend to worry about, like Oscar season. So next week, I guess we'll have a wrap-up on New York Film Festival, because that's still ongoing. So just a few more days left on all that, and we'll see how everything settles there. Hopefully, we can hear a bit more about how another virtual festival experience went, get some insight from the people who were involved about how people watched it as a national online experience, and then we'll head straight into AFI Fest. So never a dull moment in these parts.
And then we have some live guests coming later.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, we've got Ted Hope and Christine Vachon.
And Christine Vachon, united amazing, again. These are old cohorts who used to work together, and they're old friends. So we can get pretend that we're all old buds, and as we are actually, and not be so. It doesn't have to be professional formal. It can feel like we're all having a chat. That's my goal.
Yeah, I'm still going to drag the truth out of them one way or another. So TBD on that front.
No, that's our secret weapon. This is how we're going to get it.
Yeah, we'll get them. All right, Anne, have a good weekend. Talk to you later.